Welcome to the March 13th edition of Groundwire, grassroots news from people on the ground, coast to coast to coast.
On behalf of the Halifax Region Municipality, I apologize to the former Upshill residents and their descendants for what they have endured for almost 50 years.
What is happening in Palestine and to Palestinians certainly reminds people of what apartheid was in the South African context. Use of this terminology, I think, rightfully so, should awaken both a memory in people around the world of what apartheid was and the evils of it and why it is still going on today.
In this edition of Groundwire, we hear from the youth of the Flemo City Media Project in Toronto's Flemington Park. An apology and settlement for the former residents and descendants of Africville, Nova Scotia, garners mixed reactions from the community. Blind transit users in Toronto are being refused access to the city's accessible transit service, Wheeltrans. The arts community in St. John's, Newfoundland celebrates International Women's Day. And we take a look at Israeli Apartheid Week activities across the country, along with reactions by Ontario politicians and pro-Israel groups. All that is coming up, but first, the headlines. From CKUT in Montreal, here's Steve Kerr.
Canwest Global Communications has agreed to sell a controlling stake of its shares to media giant Shaw Communications. Canwest is one of Canada's largest media corporations and broadcasts channels including Global TV and the National Geographic Channel. The sale to Shaw Communications has prompted criticism from media diversity activists. Steve Anderson at openmedia.ca explained the damaging effects the sale could have.
Like a handful of companies control most media in Canada. We have a very highly concentrated media market, especially in Western Canada, where I'm at right now. And this will mean that there'll kind of be one less entity, there'll be one less media company out there.
Anderson was also concerned that the move could lead to a conflict of interest.
You know, we believe in, as much as possible, separating content and carriage. And, you know, the Shaw taking control of Canwest Broadcast, it sort of muddies the water there where now they have a commercial interest to favor their own content, and they also control the means of distribution.
The sale is pending approval by the CRTC. Part of the CRTC's mandate is to promote media diversity within Canada. Anderson closed by warning the CRTC of the potential danger of the takeover.
It's a powerful company owning yet more media.
For Groundwire, this is Steve Elton Kerr in Montreal.
Tessa Vanderhart from CJUM Winnipeg has this report.
The United Food and Commercial Workers Union says that lack of occupational health and safety coverage for Alberta's farm workers has resulted in 23 deaths and countless injuries over the past few years. If farm workers were covered under the Occupational Health and Safety Act, agricultural employers would be required to educate workers about the dangers of working on a farm and provide adequate training. Workers would also have the right to a health and safety committee and to refuse dangerous work. Stan Raper is a national coordinator of the Agriculture Workers Alliance, which operates in conjunction with the UFCW, which is the largest private sector union in Canada.
Basically the campaign called End the Harvest of Death for Alberta farm workers is to try and secure occupational health and safety legislation for agriculture workers in the province. Every other province in Canada has that protection now for agriculture workers, and Alberta is the last holdout, and something that we're working hard to try and secure for them. It's time that the Alberta government realized that there's some serious problems when workers go to work. They should be able to return back to their families and not be sent home in a box or without a limb. These are serious, serious situations, and there is an obligation on behalf of the government of Alberta to act.
Thomas Lukaszuk, Alberta's Minister of Employment and Immigration, told University of Alberta student newspaper The Gateway the government wants, quote, to make sure that our farmers are safe and that all the workers on farms are safe. But at the same time, we want to make sure that their needs are also met, that we're not paralyzing the industry. For Groundwire, this is Tessa Vanderhart from CJUM in Winnipeg.
Back to Montreal now with CKUT's Joel Bard.
On February 21st, around 100 Montrealers packed into the basement of Union United Church. The mostly black crowd attended a press conference held by two groups of youths who say that they were racially profiled and mistreated by Montreal Transit authorities. Both groups have filed complaints with the Quebec Human Rights Commission. They are also seeking financial redress. Samantha and Hyman Roberts, one of the complainants, spoke about her experience. She said that she and three friends were riding a train when they were singled out by transit authorities. After failing to produce a ticket, which she contends she'd just thrown out, officials asked her to disembark. And when she questioned them why, they physically abused her. "The authorities," she told the crowd, "grabbed me and dragged me to the ground in the train. They put their knees on my back and tried to put handcuffs on my wrist. They then wrote her over $700 worth of fines." Elaine Towes is a civil rights advocate who's been working closely with Hyman Roberts and the other youths. She says that these recent cases are nothing new, that racial profiling is a major issue in Montreal.
"Based on my work here at CRAR, I've seen many cases involving STM inspectors, some cases involving the Montreal police. When we see this type of pattern of targeting these groups of people and treating them in an abusive manner, unrespectfully, I see that as a pattern of racial profiling."
Yet despite being troubled by the pattern, Taos says she is heartened by the way Montreal's black community mobilizes around such cases. Indeed, as made evident at Union United, a strong and active support system seems to exist. Signing off for Groundwire, I'm Joel Bard.
And now for our features. First up, the Groundwire Community Radio Report. 3 years ago, the Flemo City Media Project was born in Toronto's Flemington Park. Every week since, youth have gathered to broadcast locally using a low-power, unlicensed station they built themselves, calling their station CFPK. Besides giving youth a voice, the project is also incubating new artists and forming new partnerships in the community. Groundwire introduces you to the dynamic hosts, producers, and musicians of the Flemo City Media Project.
This is the sound of Flemo City Media. Flemo City Media is a not-for-profit organization devoted to helping people, especially youth, in the Flemington Park community. We broadcast a low-power local station we called CFPK out of Flemington Park. Right now, we don't really have a license, but we're hoping to get one soon.
Hi, I'm Aisha Rowe. I'm the project coordinator for Flemo City Media.
And Alex and Huli came out with some basically random pieces of junk, came to the community center, saw some kids and was like, "Hey, we're going to try to build a radio transistor. Do you want to help?" And then one day put the antenna up on the roof and went out in his car, turned the dial while the youth in the building at the center hosted a show, and everyone was just ecstatic when they caught the frequency and they heard their voices over the air. And that really is the birth of Flemo City Media and the cornerstone of what we are. We started as CFPK Flemo City Radio, and now we've expanded to include media arts and leadership capacity building for youth. So I grew up in Thorncliffe, and so I know what it is to be a youth in this community. Flemington and Thorncliffe Park is a first and second immigrant settlement community. It has been labeled by our local government as one of the 13 priority neighborhoods, and that's because it is a low-income and community with most people living at the poverty line or below.
When you tell them where you live, I mean, I'm in show choir, right, and I'm the only Noir person there, so I consider myself Noir. I call myself Noir. One chocolate chip in a pancake batter, and it's like, that should that belong there? But then the topic just comes up, where do you live? And then you tell them Flemo or off the coast of Flemo. They're like, oh, you live there. I guess I would consider it a ghetto-y area. I mean, there's like different ethnicities here, right? So everyone comes from a different culture, and what you think is right for from your culture is wrong for another culture, right? So, like, you need to have at least one friend from every culture here. Like, I guess I would call the Resource Center the heart of Flemo in a way, because that's where most people in Flemo get to know each other.
FCM generally shows you the best of Flemington Park. It shows you the kind of stuff that most people tend not to see or overlook. So It really does. It really does put a positive spin on everything that people say is negative. My name's Tarun. I've gotten a lot of experience with talking by being on FCM, and it's helped me in school and other areas. I owe a lot to FCM for letting me do this and learn more about myself and others in the process. We have had a lot of hookups with this program. Royal Conservatory of Music, Einstein Hype, and more. Dale's been involved with most of it from the start.
Well, we had this mini-program, Unsigned Hype, that's its name. At the end of the program, one of the hosts from CHRY, her name's Ome, she invited us to go down to CHRY and actually play some of our stuff on radio live. It was a real good experience because we actually got to know what it feels like to have a timeline. We also got to play the things that we created in Unsigned Hype.
We have a lot of talented youth that come through our doors, and they're making really great music and creative material, not just music.
The only way I found out that I had a voice was I came to Flama City Media. It sort of builds your character. I mean, the radio is anonymous, right? No one's really looking at you, so you can say whatever you want. You're free to express yourself.
Right now, Flama City Media is about 3 years old. But when it started, we were actually broadcasting out of a really small closet. So considering we got from there to right now owning a fairly large room in the local rec center, I'd say we've come a long way.
Heroes only exist in the past, but the history of the future will reveal the heroes of today and how they change the world.
We'll leave you with some more music produced here in FCM.
Thanks to Flemo City Media's Adil, Taryn, and Mikey for that piece.
Nobody touching me, Rosa. I'm untouchable. King, I got powers too. X, I'm incredible. Mandela.
They try to put me down, but I keep my head up.
Through the struggle.
They try to put me down, but I keep my head up. Cause like a ball player, I just drive through. I'm on another level. You couldn't stop me
if you tried to.
Your negative is nothing to my positive. I'm so determined, there's no way that you'll be stopping it.
That was Mini C, Elastic, and Lomo with Black History Rap. You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News. We are listener-supported, not-for-profit news. To donate, visit www.ncra.ca. This month, Israeli Apartheid Week marked its sixth year of activities around the world. CFRC's Christopher Curry reports from Kingston, Ontario, on the thoughts behind and reactions to Israeli Apartheid Week in Canada.
From its origins at the University of Toronto in 2005, Israeli Apartheid Week has become a global phenomenon. This year, IAW events were held at cities across six continents. 13 cities in Canada participated, the highest number of any country. For the second year in a row, Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at Queen's University held Israeli Apartheid Week in Kingston. Featured events included an introductory address by Adam Shapiro, a founder of the International Solidarity Movement, discussions of Canadian foreign policy in Israel-Palestine, and a panel discussion on the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. In Toronto, Israeli Apartheid Week took place amid intense media scrutiny and condemnation from the political elite. Here in Kingston, the response was more muted. Kamal Riley from SPHR at Queen's explains.
There was no confrontation this year on both of our parts, on our part at SPHR and the IAW organizers, but also the opposition just never showed up. The discussions we were able to have at the talks were actually pretty engaging. At the same time, I'm not entirely convinced on its effectiveness. Next year, we may choose to take a more aggressive tone again, like they do at York.
In the build-up to Israeli Apartheid Week, I spoke with Adam Shapiro about the Israeli apartheid analogy and its usage in North America.
To draw attention internationally to the reality of what is happening in Palestine and to Palestinians certainly reminds people of what apartheid was in the South African context. Use of this terminology, I think, rightfully so, should awaken both a memory in people around the world of what apartheid was and the evils of it and why it is still going on today.
Within Israel itself, the term apartheid is used with increasing frequency. Former cabinet ministers have made use of the term in published articles. Here in North America, there's still more of a taboo around the word. I asked Adam Shapiro for his opinion as to why this would be.
I don't think it's just simply the use of the word apartheid. I think in general, and for many years now, we have seen more truth being told about what Israel is doing, how it is behaving as a state and as a government. We're seeing more of that truth being told in Israel. And yet there remains this taboo back here in North America, especially. And I think that very much is related to the role of pro-Israel lobbies, both in the United States and Canada, which are extremely strong, although I don't think we should give them over credit. But there is this historical taboo about doing anything to criticize Israel for fear of being targeted or labeled an anti-Semite. But I think that effect is weakening.
The primary focus of Israeli Apartheid Week 2010 was the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. While this initiative does not enjoy universal support in pro-Palestinian circles, many regard it as the most effective means of bringing Israeli policies under international scrutiny. John Elmer here explains the logistics of the strategy.
Each can be participated in boycott on the individual level, divestment on the group level, church level, community level, and then sanction is a national project. So you have a three-pronged strategy where people can enter on the ground floor at the boycott and ultimately work their way up.
Shortly before Israeli Apartheid Week began, the Ontario legislature passed a motion condemning the event. By way of comparison, the legislature has not passed a motion condemning the ongoing siege of Gaza. For CFRC Radio, this is Christopher Curry.
Now to Toronto, where blind transit users are being refused service on the city's accessible transit service, Wheeltrans. Karen Llewellyn reports from CHRY Toronto.
On an average day, more than 1.5 million people choose public transit in Toronto. Among them is graduate student Kevin Shaw. But he's not doing it by choice. Kevin is blind.
So now that I'm on the subway, there was some difficulty in finding the stairs at Shepherd Station. Lots of things in the way.
It's not that simple for me to just get on the subway and then go somewhere. I can attempt that, but those trips end up being very frustrating.
In most cities offering public transportation, he would be using paratransit. That's the accessible travel alternative for people with disabilities. The TTC and Wheeltrans, its paratransit division, don't think the blind should use the service, however. In fact, they go out of their way to keep blind applicants from qualifying.
Wheeltrans had contacted a third party, a blindness agency in Toronto called Balance. When I got my Wheeltrans rejection letter, I had found out through some back channels that my case had been discussed between Wheeltrans and Balance, and that included my medical information. You know, that made me feel a little violated in terms of privacy. There's something wrong here. The blind person, him or herself, should be speaking for themselves, saying, this is a service that I need.
I don't feel that Wheeltrans is very compassionate to what our needs are.
That's Louise. Louise got turned down by Wheeltrans 3 times.
The TTC does not treat blindness as a disability because we're not getting Wheeltrans. You know what? You walk in there with a white cane and you're blind and you can't see. What more does it take?
TTC spokesperson Danny Nicholson says the TTC believes its accessibility initiatives like braille signs and stop announcements mean the blind don't need Wheeltrans. He points out the Commission's Advisory Committee on Accessible Transportation includes disabled members. Blindness community activist Linda Spinney wants Wheeltrans to recognize the diverse needs of blind people.
I applied 3 years ago. As a blind person or visually impaired, I found it very frustrating to be oriented in the community independently. Mm-hmm. I was turned down. I think it's a waste of time, their system, but I had to appeal to get accepted. I just think there's a lot of people behind the scenes who do not understand what we go through. I don't think it's fair for them to consult an outside agency. Blindness is a disability. Wheeltrans should be available for blind and vision impaired adults.
Kevin, frankly, has had enough. He's written an open letter to TTC Chair Adam Grimbroni demanding change.
You know, even as a blind person, I have a right to a livelihood. I have a right to make a living. You know, as a musician, and sometimes that's going to be in a part of the city that is inaccessible. Not every single blind person experiences blindness the same way. Independence to me means being able to freely move about without any type of restriction. Dignity seems to be one of the things that is missing from this definition of independent travel.
I would tell the chief to get a blindfold with a white cane in the winter especially and try getting on a TTC bus and see what it's like.
For Groundwire, this is Karen Llewellyn.
We go now to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where the city has recently apologized to the former residents of Africville, a community that was destroyed in the 1960s under the banner of urban renewal. CKDU's David Parker reports on the mixed reactions to the apology and the agreement signed with the Africville Genealogical Society to settle its 14-year-old legal action against the city of Halifax.
In a press conference on February 24th, Halifax Mayor Peter Kelly apologized to the former residents and descendants of Africville, Nova Scotia.
On behalf of the Halifax Region Municipality, I apologize to the former Africville residents and their descendants for what they have endured for almost 50 years. Ever since the loss of your community, we had stood on the shores of Bedford Basin for some 150 years. You lost your homes, your church, all the places in which you gathered with your family and friends to share and mark the milestones of your lives. For all of that, we apologize.
The Halifax Regional Municipality and the Africville Genealogy Society reached a deal in what many are calling backroom negotiations. The deal would award $3 million in compensation that would go towards erecting a heritage site with a museum and a reconstruction of the historic church. The money would be matched by $250,000 from the Canadian government towards an African Nova Scotian Affairs Department. Some community members were overjoyed. Brenda Steed Ross is a former Africville resident who was evicted along with her parents and her infant daughter when she was 18.
We got to look to the future. We got to look for our youth. And the future is bright. And the apology and all that's to follow is what's going with us and to help us with our future.
Some community members were outraged. Eddie Carvery has been living at Seaview Park, the former site of Africville, in a protest caravan for 10 to 20 years. He is demanding a public inquiry, individual compensation for former residents, and the land to be returned to the community.
I'm still in Africville, right today. Anybody riding by, they can see my little caravan of freedom fighters fighting for what we all should be fighting for. I'll say our fight has just started. Anyone that agrees with me will come out to Abbeville and we'll fight for our individual compensation. We will fight for a public inquiry. Thank you for the apology. Accepted. Two more to go.
Denise Allen is a former resident who claims the settlement process has been illegal. Here she provides some historical context.
Africville was a vibrant community until the government permitted the invasion of hazardous industries such as three dumps, four sets of railroad tracks, a coal factory, a tannery, a mill, nail factory, infectious disease hospital, rockhead prison, fertilizer plant, etc., and the list goes on and on and on. What they did to Africville is the most blatant and extreme illustration of environmental racism I have ever encountered, the purpose of which was to chase the people of Africville out by hook or by crook in order to control access to the valuable land lawfully bought and paid for by the Africville residents. The people of Africville were denied any consultations on any of the hazardous industries that no other community would accept in their backyards. The people of Africville were denied services, including public schooling, water, sewage, firefighting, paved roads, sidewalks, recreational facilities and policing, waste removal and electricity, all services that the rest of Halifax enjoyed. To say that Africville reminds us of a stark example of how racism permeates Canadian society is an understatement. The people of Africville have been victimized by anti-black racism. The compensation settlement does not come close to making up for what was stolen from the people of Africville. Today, the government is forcing its will on the Africville Genealogy Society in a patronizing way, having dictated the terms to them. Hardly what you would call good faith negotiations.
For Groundwire, this is David Parker at CKBU in Halifax.
Do you enjoy talking about Africville?
No, I don't.
Why not?
Because it hurts me.
Why is that, Mr. Chief? Why does it hurt you to talk about Africville?
Because it's one of the nicest little communities I ever lived in. And to tell you something, I've been around this world twice. I've never met a place like Africville. Never.
But Mr. Steed, everybody thought it was such a bad place.
Who?
All the people who tore it down.
Oh, the people that tore it down. That's the people that tore it down, the city of Halifax, the authorities of the city of Halifax.
They said it was a bad place.
That's what they called it. But it was not to us, it was a heaven, a home, a real home.
You can't put a price on the lives that they ruined. No reparations, no nothing. Why would you do this? Divide my people to fight out on the corners at night. Oh, Africville, look what they've done to me.
It's a part of our history they kept in the closet. Professors never taught the lessons, they neglected, forgot it. They kept it underneath the table, kept it under the surface. Nervous that we were re-emerging, they dispersed us and jerked us out in Africville. Halifax is ill, how can us blacks rebuild? When the facts reveal, the government left them comatose. And younger and the older folks in black Nova Scotian souls are frozen. Many homes are broken, drugs started creeping in, crime started seeping in. The heaven got crushed when the demons started sneaking in. A black community lost and trampled, left out in shambles, dismantled, and it's still hard to handle.
That was Africville by Black Union. Communities across Canada and around the world marked International Women's Day on March 8th. Sarah Feldblum of CHMR in St. John's reports on how the St. John's arts community is celebrating the global event.
St. John's, Newfoundland is the oldest English-founded settlement in North America. There's a traditionalism that's very alive in the culture of the city. Here, slang for a woman is Mrs., and anyone from your boss to a middle-aged man who regularly passes you on the street might call you darling. But there is also a history of strong women heartily taking on challenges here. This International Women's Week, St. John's is flooded with events to honor womanhood. I spoke with Michelle Bush, director of Eastern Edge Gallery, an artist-run center in St. John's that hosts an annual International Women's Day exhibition.
I think it's important to always remember that no matter what people say, women still aren't equal on all levels in society. We need to celebrate the amazing, awesome work that we all do. You know, promote that and make people aware of the supportive structure of a lot of organizations that are based around women.
I asked Michelle why International Women's Week programming is supported and produced at the gallery annually.
The gallery was built up by quite a few really strong, fabulous women artists. And at the time, and even now, it was really important to create a space for women artists to exhibit and to promote their work. It's one of the elements that the gallery adheres to, that it's really important to have diversity. It's important to have women presented.
This year, she said Yes Theatre Company is hosting the 4th annual Women's Work Festival for Works in Progress by Women Playwrights for 3 nights at Eastern Edge Gallery. And the International Women's Day exhibition has brought in 2 artists from Montreal, Julie Lequin and Janice Yanyan Wu, who are mounting pieces called Top 30 and Knitting Machine. This is Sarah Feldblum of CHMR in St. John's, reporting for Groundwire.
That does it for this edition of Groundwire, a nonprofit national news program produced every 2 weeks by our communities for our communities. Groundwire is heard on dozens of campus and community radio stations across the country. This edition was produced at CKDU on Mi'kmaq territory in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Groundwire thanks the Canadian Union of Public Employees for their support. To get in touch with Groundwire, email groundwire@ncra.ca. All episodes of Groundwire are available for listening or podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca.